This is the podcast that puts you at the pointy end of the airplane with two veteran airline captains. We'll offer insight into the pilot brain, we'll have some fun, and promise not to get too techie. Each weekly episode has a segment that provides inside information on what's really going on behind the cockpit door, and we'll discuss some industry current topics that might affect your travels. Your two pilots and co-hosts are Les Abend and Mike Strauss. Les has over four decades and over 25,000 hours of experience flying airplanes. The Boeing 727, 757, 767, and the 777 were all part of Les's repertoire before he retired. He was also a Czech airman. Additionally, Les still has the good fortune to be a 21-year contributing editor for Flying Magazine. He's been an on-air analyst and op-ed contributor for CNN, in addition to MSNBC and NBC, among others. And finally, Les is the author of Paper Wings, a mystery suspense whodunit thriller. Mike is a current A320 captain and Czech airman for a major airline with over 17,000 hours of flight time. In addition to his airline experience, Mike has a diverse general aviation background as an airplane salesman and a corporate pilot flying celebrities and VIPs. If you haven't done so already, please listen to the Welcome Aboard introductory episode. Don't get on an airplane until you've listened to Candid Cockpit.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Candid Cockpit. My name is Les Abend. On this takeoff segment, we'll discuss the runway incursion event that occurred at JFK where two airplanes could have collided. It was a pretty serious situation.
Very much so.
Reminiscent of something that happened way back when. We'll talk about that, but it's under investigation.
And we may never know. Well, we certainly don't know all the answers now, and it may be quite a while before we do learn all the answers. As we talked, it's kind of a, what we know right now is only the tip of the iceberg.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. So.
And my name is Mike Strauss. For the crew segment, tilt your seat back and prepare for discussion on airline pilot hiring criteria, which in itself, obviously we're in a pilot shortage. The world knows it. The world has experienced it. And the criteria has changed dramatically just in the last year or two, you know. Certainly from when we got hired, and it's a little cyclical, but in the last year or two is pretty big. And I think the public wants to know why and how the airlines are addressing the pilot shortage.
Yeah, and how we're getting, I mean, you know, to me, it's a pilot experience shortage more than it is just pilot shortage because we can find people. But at the end of the day, you're absolutely correct. You know, the difference when I got hired competitive wise versus when you got hired,
right?
It's two different things, and now it's, you know, it's a totally different,
unrecognizable almost. Yeah.
But we'll discuss.
All like that. You said, it's the experience.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then finally, for the landing segment, we'll talk about the decision process in deciding to abandon a landing and proceed to an alternate airport. You know, how was that decision made? We'll talk about all the activity that's involved with it, and appropriately, you had that very experience.
Just recently. Yeah, just recently.
So I think it's going to be great. You'll talk about having to divert.
And it's, you know, it's not fun for anybody. Believe me, it's not fun for the passengers, and it certainly isn't fun for the crew, because the crew is probably supposed to be someplace. You run into legality issues of the rest to get, you know, to carry on back to that original destination. So there's, again, tip of the iceberg. But maybe we can address a portion of it.
I mean, it's, you know, we'll talk about it as well. But, I mean, there's a lot involved in the cockpit, of the, you know, between the go-around situation, if that's what you have to do, and then preparing to go to another destination.
It gets pretty busy.
It gets very busy, yeah.
And you've got a lot of, and you're also getting a lot of help from dispatch, from company operations at the airport you were going to, and you've got to talk to the operations where you're going.
Because they want to know where you're headed.
And then the controllers are like, hey, where are you going?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And this diversion, by the way, to remind people, occurred during these terrible, terrible storms out in California.
On the West Coast, yeah.
The West Coast of California.
Yeah, so, yeah, it certainly did.
Okay.
Okay, folks, invite your friends to Candid Cockpit Podcast. Send an email with a suggestion or suggest a topic to podcast@candidcockpit.com, and we'll mention your name on air. Also, don't forget to watch us. We're now published on YouTube, and you can get there either straight through YouTube or some links on Facebook, Instagram, and what was the other one?
Well, they're on your favorite podcast episode.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. We're on a directory actually in New York City.
In New York City, yeah.
New York City podcast.
So there's a lot of ways to get to us.
A lot of ways to get in, right. Everybody.
And we'd appreciate it if you'd come take a look.
Invite your friends and come listen to us and watch us make fools of ourselves. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you're good at something, you stick with it. But you'll keep coming, which might keep bringing people back. But more importantly, we're looking for your input to give us ideas of other things to talk about. You know, we're the guys sitting up there, but you're the people in the back of the airplane that have questions.
Yeah, just last night. Matter of fact, I was at a little dinner party, and we got into a big discussion about how things happen behind the scenes. So we want to listen. It was very good.
Everybody wants to know what goes on behind a closed door, whether it's a closed door of a cockpit or it's a closed door of the office right now.
Absolutely.
You know, people are standing outside going, I wonder what's going on in there.
Sometimes.
I mean, by people, I mean your wife.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome to our takeoff segment. We're going to discuss this runway incursion event at Kennedy that could have turned into a real tragedy. But before we get to the actual aspect of what happened, Mike, since you're the one that's actively flying, talk about all the procedures that are involved of getting to the runway. You don't have to start from operations, but from the airplane, what are the things you do to safely get to the runway, your interaction with the controllers?
And getting to the right runway.
And getting to the right runway.
And ironically, I am based at JFK Airport, so I'm very familiar with this taxi route, these taxi instructions, and the JFK controllers.
I have about 10,000 hours doing just that taxi.
I would think,
At JFK.
Yeah. So
we're both very familiar.
It's not like just driving down the highway or getting on a freeway on-ramp and not all of a sudden trying to just merge onto a freeway. You don't move an airplane without a clearance.
Right.
And that clearance starts, let's say we've already pushed back off the gate, all your pre-taxi or after-start checklists are complete, and you're ready to go to the runway. First thing you need to do is you got to talk to, you could be talking to a ramp controller, depending on how the airport is set up. And that's someone who just manages the ramp and nothing more.
Right.
They put you in a place to talk to the ground controller, and the ground controller is who's going to get you to the runway safely.
Can I take you back just a little bit?
Yeah. There's
one important aspect is that you listen to an automated weather service called ATIS.
ATIS, yep.
The Automatic Terminal Information Service. And it runs every hour.
Yep.
Kennedy Airport ATIS Information Hotel, 16510. Winds 170 at 12. Visibility 10. View clouds at 1,200. Ceiling 5,000 overhead. Temperature 2.17. Altimeter 2983. Approach and use ILS runway 22 left. ILS runway 22 right.
And it gives the weather, but one of the more important aspects of
gives the runway.
Gives the runway.
Gives the takeoff, the departure and arrival runways.
Right.
And some airports will have a takeoff clearance, a departure clearance, and a separate arrival clearance.
Correct.
But you're right. Yeah, I failed to mention that. They do the change of weather every hour, and it just gives you the local, basically, the winds, the temperature, the clouds, ceiling of the clouds, if there are any. It gives you a temperature and a dew point to determine whether or not you may have some fog or other weather from that temperature dew point. And it gives you an altimeter setting.
And it's all a standard format that you get.
It is.
Right? And the important thing is, as it relates to this particular incident, is that you have an expectation of what runway, because, you know, in this day and age, we entered into the computer, which corresponds to all of our takeoff data.
Correct.
For a particular runway.
For performance. Correct.
Because every runway is a different length.
Right.
Maybe it has a different gradient. So all our computer-based performance is all based on that. And that's
so
important.
As you're right. That's the first expectation of what runway you can expect.
Right.
So once you've listened to weather, you are also going to get a flight clearance, a clearance for your flight that's going to describe the runway you're departing from,
correct,
the route you're going to take, the altitude to which you're going, and a couple of other little pieces of information, a transponder code, which basically tags up with air traffic control so they know who you are, where you are, and where you're going, and a departure frequency. But again,
And one thing that's important to bring up that you kind of touched on is that clearance, your clearance to your destination, includes a departure clearance, which corresponds to that particular
runway. Right? Exactly.
So as you and I know, when you depart off of 4 left at Kennedy, that's a different, what we call standard instrument departure,
right?
A SID versus the SID on runway 31 left.
They're different. Vastly different. And it's tough to, you couldn't mix those two up if you tried.
But they're named in our, what we call our approach plates.
Right.
So we know the route to follow, and the computer actually
right.
will follow.
We'll fly that.
We'll fly that. So that's important to know as well.
It is. And again, that's the second time that you've been given a runway that you should expect.
Right.
So yeah, so then you've done this, you've gotten your ATIS, you've gotten your clearance. In your mind, you know, the crew, again, this is why there's two of them up there, that this is the runway we're going to. You've entered that information into the flight management system, the FMS, the computer, so to speak, that does most of the work. So you have this in your mind. You've discussed the clearance. You've discussed the departure itself. And again, off of 31 left, great. I'll just interject real quick. Off of 31 left, it's a complicated departure. You take off the runway and it's immediate left turn to a couple of different waypoints and fixes.
And help our audience. Why is that a complicated? What because of obstructions, right?
Yeah, the obstructions. It's called Manhattan.
It's called Manhattan, exactly.
Because you're taking off. And trust me, taking off on 31 left at sunset, gorgeous. Absolutely. Because you've got
the best pictures,
exactly.
I've always, yeah.
So you've got the sun setting behind Manhattan, and it is gorgeous. Now, to the contrary, you take off of 4 left, again, and I think we've discussed this, the runways are numbered for the degrees on a compass.
Right.
So you're 31 left, you're taking off to the northwest, 4 left, you're taking off to the northeast.
Right. 310 degrees.
Correct.
Or 40 degrees.
40 degrees.
Right.
So on 4 left, it's a heading departure. You get to a certain point, 1.5 miles past, call it the middle of the JFK airport, and you've got distant measuring equipment to determine exactly when that point is. Or ATC will just say, hey, American 106, turn right heading 100. That's as simple as it gets.
Right.
Where the one off of 31 left is far more complicated.
Right. And then it follows what we call waypoints.
Correct.
Spots in the sky that have latitude and longitude spots. We won't get into the weeds on that. But at the end of the day, it is a more complicated departure.
Yeah, it is.
And it's very important. You brought up briefing. You brief the crew not only for that standard instrument departure when everything is normal, but you also
know where you're going.
You also brief the crew on
engine failure performance.
Yeah.
And again, that runway has, you know, 4 left, simple. If you lose an engine after a certain point, you just fly that runway heading
safely.
You can safely without worrying about obstruction.
Right.
Off of 31 left, you get to a certain point. And there's two different ways to put that, so you can paint that on your instruments. When you get to this point, you make a left turn heading southbound, which takes you away from the obstruction.
Over the ocean.
Yeah. Over the ocean.
Where there's no obstructions, right.
Short of a cruise ship or a oil tanker.
Yeah.
So there's so much, again, tip of the iceberg. There's so much that has been discussed before the wheels even start rolling on the jet towards the runway. In theory, all of these things are still in your mind, because this is what you're going to have to... what you're about to go do. Something went wrong with the American crew. They might have had, and we'll talk about this, they might have had expectations. Anyway, so now you're talking to ground. Ground's going to give you a taxi clearance. And I'll use Americans. They were told to turn left on taxiway Bravo. All taxiways are named or numbered, lettered, so to speak.
Right. They were coming out of their ramp.
Their ramp
exit was called taxiway Tango Alpha.
Okay.
And that was one of the egresses, one of the exits out of there.
That's the on-ramp.
That's basically,
so to speak, the on-ramp to get to the highway. The highway is
exactly right.
Taxiway Bravo. So you turn left on turn left on taxiway Bravo, hold short of taxiway Kilo. And the ground controller should always provide you with a runway destination and then the taxiing clearance. So the clearance would have gone something along the lines of American 106, Kennedy Ground, taxi to runway 4 left, turn left on Bravo, hold short of Kilo.
Right, and you said it right because you said the runway first.
Right.
Now there's the expectation. And one thing, just backing up a little bit, we talked about the expectation and the fact that we listened to this, the weather beforehand, this ATIS, this Automatic Terminal Information Service. It doesn't preclude the fact that, indeed, because of weather, wind change, the runway could change.
Could change.
Could change. And that, but that says in your head, oh, wow, I've got to change the data on the computer. I got to change
new performance numbers.
New performance numbers, and that triggers a lot of stuff.
It does.
It's not a big deal, but you have to apply yourself and know that. But in this particular circumstance, we're not really sure that happened. It doesn't sound like it happened.
Correct.
But
again, tip of the iceberg, we don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know.
We've listened to the tapes, and the tapes did dictate runway 4 left to that American crew.
They did.
You know?
They did. There was nothing that indicated that had been a change from the departure runway from that automatic terminal information
service. Correct. Correct.
So, but anyhow, I interrupted you.
No, you're good.
This I interrupted is the, your taxi.
What? Yeah. So, yeah. And funny, when we get interrupted taxis, a lot of times the first officer is kind of task saturated because they're the ones that have got to make all the changes in the computer. The idea is the captain, your goal, you are nothing but outside, a swivel outside, making sure. And you usually, if your first officer is not heads down, so to speak, and we'll talk about that, on the way to the runway, they're helping you look to make sure that you're doing the right things. And we've all had it happen. You know, I go to turn left on Alpha and they wanted me on Bravo. Oop, sorry, you know, and I carry on. Typically with no, hey, can you make a phone call kind of thing.
Right.
But that's always why there's two of us up there to watch out for each other.
You brought up something very important, and I don't know if you were going to go there, so my apologies for interrupting, but you said something about being heads down. That means the co-pilot's putting in data,
right,
doing other tasks while the captain is taxiing the airplane.
Correct.
And it's important to know most airplanes only have one way of steering the airplane on the ground, which is a tiller on the left side,
right,
of the captain. Now, the 777, an American 777, it's actually, they do have a tiller on the co-pilot side.
We've got one on our little light twin as well.
But most of most airlines, it's the captain that's doing the taxi.
I've discovered that in the U.S., I think it's every airline, period, that the captain does the taxi.
Correct.
But I've discovered through a mutual friend of ours, Mark Sapper, who just recently retired from Virgin Atlantic, the first officer, if it's their leg, they're taxiing.
I've done that, especially with a captain or a first officer that I've flown with that is getting close to upgrade. Or sometimes for a safety reason, a lot of times there's something I need to adjust or there's some data that I want to verify.
Right.
And I go, it's straight away taxiway, not a big deal. I would tell the co-pilot, you got the airplane.
Yeah, just taxi. Yeah.
Just taxi the airplane.
Yeah.
But where I was going more than anything else was that if that co-pilot is working on entering the data or whatever task, the statement usually should be, I'm heads down.
I'm heads down.
I'm heads down.
That gives the captain then knows exactly what's going on and that his situation awareness has to come to a little bit higher level because he knows he doesn't have anybody else to watch out for him.
Right. He doesn't have the backstop of doing that. Now, we'll find out from the cockpit voice recorder whether that was actually stated. And
right.
I'm willing to speculate that it wasn't.
I got to say, it's pretty rare that someone will actually say it. It's funny. I find it more with our seasoned co-pilots than I do our new co-pilots.
The newer co-pilots
are not
saying it.
Are not saying,
not
it.
Saying it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I kind of would have thought would have been the opposite. And I've been flying with a lot of new co-pilots lately, but I would have kind of thought the opposite.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm having to... Hey, are you,
I would have thought the exact opposite as well. Okay.
And I'll say, hey, are you heads down? Oh, yeah, I'm heads down. Little memory jog. But again, new guys, new pilots, new co-pilots to the airline, a lot of stuff going on. Again.
And that's once again, you segued into something for me, is that this particular co-pilot on American Airlines was not new to the airline. She had been a veteran of the 737,
right.
New York-based co-pilot, as far as I know. But she just had finished the required 100 hours before you can be released.
Consolidation.
Yeah.
Without any restrictions to the line.
Well, without having to fly with a Czech airman. So you could go to the line. So she was familiar with the airplane. She'd gone through all the Czech rides. She was ready to go. But, she just isn't at that she's what I would call the awkward stage. She just, you know, developing a comfort level.
Right.
She probably wasn't right there. And she got called out on reserve, is my understanding.
So again, not necessarily in a mindset, this is the trip I'm going to go do or something like that.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps. But she had numerous times been out of
camp. And that will take us to something, again, kind of getting away from how we're getting to the runway. But didn't American Airlines just institute some new work, a little bit of new workload for the co-pilot?
Let's go there in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's back go to getting to the runway. Bit. So there we are. We're chugging right along on taxiway Bravo.
Right.
If you haven't done your pre-takeoff checklist or your pre-takeoff flight control checks, so on and so forth, there's tasks that need to be accomplished. Sometimes they're accomplished before you start taxiing. Sometimes they're accomplished while you're taxiing.
Correct.
Completely standard. So you get those done. You're still kind of watching, obviously very much watching where you're going. There's still two of you up there kind of multitasking. You get to this intersection, this hold short of intersection Kilo, and you're just going to stop and sit there and wait for further instruction. What should have taken place or what did take place was American 106, cross runway 31 left at intersection Kilo, monitor the tower. So they would, at that point, make the right turn, cross a runway, and there's some procedures for crossing a runway. The co-pilot cannot be heads down during a runway crossing.
That's right.
You've got to turn different lights on.
Right.
You've got to turn additional lights on, strobe lights and wing or runway lights. Get across that runway, then you can go back to doing what you need to do to prepare for departure.
Right.
As you're rolling closer to your departure runway, you put in the tower frequency. They'll call you. We'll call you, don't call us method. And they'll give you your departure clearance from there, and off you go. But it took us a long time to get from Tango Alpha to the runway. There's a lot of stuff to do.
And, you know, in this particular circumstance, had they gone to the correct runway, the four left, there's a lot of, it's 15 minutes at least, even if you're the only airplane on the field.
Yeah, because you're going relatively slow. And Kennedy's a big place. I mean, that's got to be, I'll bet that's a 3 or 4 mile trip from Tango Alpha to 4 left.
It takes a while to get there.
It's almost as far as you can get on that airport from one corner to the other.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of things, something else that to mention is that we get in the habit of when we do cross the runway, we go clear left. And usually the captain's the one on the left side. So he says clear left.
Co-pilot says
clear right. Clear right. So that's a little. And I even do it in the small airplane,
yeah. You know,
to myself.
Yeah, so, I do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put across, clear left, clear right.
Because you don't know if there's a vehicle, if there's an airplane landing on the wrong one.
Right.
You know, so it's...
I get my wife to say clear right when I can get her to stop looking at the clouds.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's an event just to get to the runway. And it requires, I'm going to say, I dare say, almost more attention to get to the runway than once you're off the runway. Because once you're off the runway, you've got so much automation that will help you fly the aircraft.
Right.
But on the ground,
yeah,
you're eating a cheeseburger while driving a stick shift on the 405 on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
There's a lot of things. And the checklist, you know, there. Now, that's an important thing to mention is that because of the fact that it's easy to get distracted at a critical time. Most airlines have taken a checklist that used to be pretty hairy, I'll say, pretty long, and toned it down to very few items.
Agreed.
So almost everything is accomplished at the gate,
right? You know, before you've even started the airplane moving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we do flight controls is one that we do. Taxiing, which obviously is an important one to make sure flight controls work, and you don't want to interfere, with potentially a truck underneath the wing of the airplane,
right?
You know that was
staying in his lane.
Yeah, not staying in his lane. So I mean, you don't operate flight controls or flaps, you know, which is part of the flight control. So that's one of the things that are on that checklist, but it's been narrowed down.
Yeah, maybe not even a handful of items, few as possible.
I seem to remember, like on the 777, there was like 5.
I'm counting mine right now. Flap verification, performance verification, flight controls, flight director.
Yeah, it's
that's about it.
That's about it.
Yeah.
So that was the objective, was to prevent distractions.
Yeah.
So Anything else on getting to the runway that we can enlighten people on?
There's, like I said, it's a lot to get to the runway.
It's usually pretty routine.
In theory, it is pretty routine, but when someone throws something at you or you've got an expectation in your mind, or I hate to say this, even a little bit of complacency.
Yeah.
It's funny. I watch the co-pilots I fly with and they'll write down almost every instruction we get. A little harder for the captain to do it because he's hand in the tiller and he's got his hands on the thrust levers trying to move the airplane around. But I do catch, and I do this as regularly, on that taxi clearance, we got, you know, Tango Alpha, left Bravo, short a kilo.
Yep.
I will at the very least put in the scratch pad of our flight management system, yep, or FMS, hold, you know, and there's a, you know, either a minus or a slash kilo. So I can just look down and go, oh, yep, got to hold short a kilo.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a reminder.
Yeah. The co-pilots I flew with were very, very good with that. And I have to do it sometimes now with my little airplane. So, it's a really good point, is to have written down that clearance. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because you can also just look at it. A, it's a reminder. And if you write it down, it seems to stick in your brain a little bit better because you've now had to repeat it or write it
down.
But
here's the thing. We go back to potentially complacency and routine. That taxi clearance I received thousands of times,
right?
You know, and you just kind of, okay,
yeah, sure. This is standard taxi.
Yeah.
But again, this is where the complacency or the expectation, which you'll talk about later, the expectation of, well, maybe the winds favored this runway, but they're actually using this one because of one reason or another. So you've got in your mind that you're going to this runway, but you really end up someplace else.
So let's talk about the incident itself, unless you have more to add about
no,
the taxi.
No, we're at the runway, and so now here we are. We
sort of described how there's a lot involved with getting to a taxiway. But anyhow, or to the runway itself. So let's talk about the incident itself. So we've touched on it, what the clearance was, the co-pilot responded. The controller should have got a confirmation on the runway. But they get busy, you know.
Right.
And this is, like I said, it's a standard clearance. So the controller should have said, confirm the runway or something to that effect. But that was never, that never happened. I'm not blaming the controller by any
right.
means.
Right. I didn't hear it on the tape.
But where we're going to go with this is the Swiss cheese aspect, where an incident involves layers of Swiss cheese, and you never want to try to get through
all the holes lined up.
Yeah. And this was one layer of that Swiss cheese that
could have prevented it.
Could have prevented it right there. But in any case, so we went past that Swiss cheese into that one particular hole, and now we're proceeding on the taxiway. And then the controller told the airplane, or told American Airlines, that they were clear to cross another runway. Which they didn't. They crossed the active runway.
They crossed the runway they were supposed to be going to.
Correct.
Instead of, and they crossed the runway they thought they were going to.
Correct. Yeah. And hopefully for those watching YouTube, I'll be able to put up a little animation on the screen and show you. But they're
on a chart, yeah.
They're intersecting runway. So Delta had already been this Delta 737 had been cleared into position and was cleared for takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
And then American, at some point, ended up crossing the runway that Delta was taking off of, which is just a total, you know, that just makes a controller's heart sink. And
the controller let that be known with his first comment.
Yeah. I mean, they must have had heart palpitations.
I'm sure.
That whole thing. And so, you know, we can talk about it now, but that kudos to the controller.
100%.
You know, even the ground controller, there's a separate recording of the ground controller telling American to stop, hold the position, but I think it was too late at that point.
Yeah, I think they were already passed and on through the runway.
Passed. But in any case, my understanding was that they got within, at least the news media was reporting that they got within 1,000 feet of the 777. The Delta 737,
right,
and they called reject.
Yeah, at a relatively high speed, 104 knots,
and a high speed board is everything over
in 80 knots. We have you reject your departure for almost anything below 80 knots,
right.
And from 80 knots to your decision speed V1, and this brings up potentially some good topics. What are the speeds we determine a future topic is, you know, speeds we determine to depart and when we do. And when
there are some decision speeds and, yeah, and some action speeds.
So the first one is V1. And basically, there are a handful of items you're going to reject your departure, your takeoff between 80 knots and V1. Anything after V1, no matter what it is, you take it in the air and deal with it in the air.
That's because the airplane can basically fly on one engine at that
point. At that point, and clear any obstacles that might be in the way there. Yeah. Again, future topics. But yeah.
Yeah.
So 104 knots doesn't sound like much. Yeah, it's 120 miles an hour. If you want to do the real math, 119.7 miles an hour. But
it's fast. And at the bottom line, that's just not a routine.
No, it's not.
That we want to do.
No.
And it's
aggressive.
It's very aggressive and it's very serious. We practice it in the simulator.
We do.
All the time, right? But where this all started to go awry was, you know, at the point that the takeoff roll had already begun for Delta. Mm-hmm. And then you go, well, how come Delta couldn't see the airplane?
It's dark.
Size of a 777.
Yeah.
Because it is dark. It's all you've got at that angle is just a silhouette until you get up close.
Yeah. And one little green light.
And right. And you have it. That's exactly right. There's the nav light is what you're on the wingtip.
Yeah.
Which is green on the right side.
Right. And maybe a strobe light, but was it on? And think about that level at in New York at JFK Airport. There are so many lights in your field of view.
Right. And what are you focused on takeoff?
Rolling down the runway, rolling down the right runway.
And you're checking, you know, you're checking engine instrumentation.
Checking speeds.
Speeds and all that. So, and your expectation is not to have
anybody in your way.
In your way. Now, during the daytime, that would have maybe been
a little more
apparent.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that point. But in this case, it wasn't. Anyhow, it was a disaster that that was unfolding that never happened. A tragedy that never happened.
Fortunately.
But now that American had crossed the wrong runway and went to the other side, you know, there was an exchange and between the controller and the pilots. And that's not really important. But I think they realized that they had done something wrong at that point. But for Delta, it's not over.
Not even close.
So maybe you can speak of that.
I mean, you do a high-speed reject. Now, it's, again, very busy in the aircraft. Violent's not the word, but aggressive is the word. Because you've got a brake setting, an automated brake setting, that if you reject or pull the thrust levers back, above a certain speed, my aircraft at 72 knots, it triggers this aggressive brake application. You also have to know, you know, automatic brake application. But you still, as the pilot, you've got to bring the thrust levers back to idle because you're at full power. You've got to get the thrust reversers out. That brake action has also created it's brought the ground spoilers up on the wing,
right,
which helps slow speed to keep destroying lift
yeah, on the wing. Yeah.
So there's a lot going on.
And we're dealing with this day and age of carbon brakes,
yeah,
which dissipates the heat quicker, but maybe not.
You're going really fast. You know, you're trying to slow down what's a fully loaded 737 that was on its way to Santo Domingo, probably carrying 30,000 pounds of gas, probably weighs 170, 160,000 pounds.
At least.
I don't know which model it was, but it was an 800. But anyway, it's a lot. It's heavier than your, you know.
You're stopping a freight train.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
You're stopping in a very short distance. And kudos to those carbon fiber brakes, which actually work a little better when they are warmer.
True.
But yeah, they got that airplane stopped rather quickly.
I'm sure they were bright red, those brakes, but
I guarantee.
It's
funny. Even the controller knows this because the controller said to Delta, do you need time on the runway to run checklist, which takes you to the hot brakes.
So bring that up.
Yeah. So if the brakes get too hot, there is a checklist for it. You have brake fans, but there's things that have to happen inside that aircraft before you move it. You might not move that airplane on its own power. You might just sit there and they might have to come tow you off the runway because the brakes got too hot to be effective even on the taxiway back into the gate.
But there is a checklist in a boarding takeoff checklist or rejected takeoff.
Right.
Checklist, I think, is what it's now called, that you have to go through. And it does cover exactly what you're saying about the brakes. And there's a chart that you can go into, you know, and I'm sure the 737 has actual brake readouts, as did the 777. and you go into this chart to determine, can I even park the brakes?
Yeah, can you set the brakes?
Set the parking brake,
yeah.
And then the other part of it is your thrust reversers, right?
Yeah.
You've got to go back to the gate so the mechanics can check
the thrust reversers and no FOD has been ingested into the engine.
And what's FOD?
Foreign object debris, which is just stuff around the ramp, stuff around the runway. You know, you see stuff in the middle of the freeway. That's FOD.
Yeah.
Typically, when you land, you use the thrust reversers. Some airlines dictate just using them on idle. Some situations will require that you use full thrust reverse. But they must be stowed by a certain speed.
Right.
In a rejected takeoff, there is no restriction on that. You are using full thrust reverser all the way to the point the aircraft stops.
Which is conducive to sucking in that, because you're actually directing jet engine air another way to stop the airplane.
Right.
So, and it's utilizing that air redirection to potentially suck up.
Yeah. More FOD.
And the 737's
engines sit so low.
They sit very low.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a lot involved for them. They ended up taxiing back to the gate. I have a feeling the airplane was fine, even at that speed. But I think it shook the crew up. And I would think so. I think that it turned out that Delta never departed.
At least not with that crew.
No.
I think they either canceled that flight or they delayed it several hours to the morning.
Right.
But
the interesting thing was the American crew departed off the runway that they were not supposed to utilize. I mean, it's available to them.
So
they were already in that position.
Right. So that brings up an interesting thing. You know, when tower or ground control probably told them to contact clearance delivery for a new clearance, because they had a clearance off of 4 left. And as we talked about, the departure off of runway 31 left is completely different. So I wonder if that triggered in their minds, we're not supposed to be here.
Right. Yeah.
No comments were made on the ATC tapes, but I would think that would have triggered something in their minds that, it's just the runway where we have it in here, but they're telling us now we have a clearance for this runway. Probably picking up their paperwork and clearance, looking at the original clearance.
I'm sure all of this will be discovered, during the investigation. Yeah. But, the sad thing was that crew knew that something was not
right.
And they parted for London. Whether en route, they were advised by the company, via printer or on the radio. It's hard to say. However, I know for a fact they didn't fly back
right. The
following day.
Yeah.
Another crew ended up
taking the trip,
which rightfully so, because their heads wouldn't have been in the game.
No, agreed. Yeah. And had they known what had taken place, perhaps they might not have been in a position to even fly to London.
Correct.
You know, and it's, and I don't mean that from a weakness standpoint. I mean that from a professional standpoint. You know, I'm not putting any doubt on the crew itself. A mistake was made. We're human.
Yeah.
But we take our job so seriously, and we are our own worst critics.
Yeah.
So we beat ourselves up probably more than anybody else.
And that being said, you brought up earlier the change in American Airlines procedures, mm-hmm. and whether that was enough of a distraction to contribute as a factor to this whole thing is yet to be seen. But what happened was, untypical, American basically did training by bulletin. So fleet-wide, it's called fleet harmonization. So all the airplanes, when we say fleet, all of the airplanes have standard operating procedures.
Correct.
And a lot of them are the same for each airplane. So if you get those ingrained, when you transition to another airplane, you're familiar with those basic operating procedures.
It's just going to be certain things, insulated to that particular new aircraft.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
But the overall general operating procedures were for the airline.
There was a lot of 35 pages of this bulletin, and I saw it as a monumental change in procedures, and they did it simply by bulletin, and they gave it toward the first part of December, and then instituted it on January 3rd. And in a letter to pilots, it was told by upper level pilot management, you can integrate both, whatever you're comfortable with, you know, do a little of the old, a little of the new. And that's just, for trouble.
That's just sticking a wedge in SOPs. I mean, it really is.
And what could have been done was distance learning. Right.
Well, that's where I was going to go. Was it simply a letter they had to read? Was there any verification that they read this letter, or did they have to do computer based training, which we call QDL, quarterly distance
that's
learning?
That's why the union got spun up on it, and the union called it reckless, because exactly. I mean, the best way to go through it is let everybody cycle through recurrent
training
and do it that way. But even distance learning would have given them, as you said, a record that they had read this information. And not only did the bulletin go through all of these operating procedures and the changes, but it also went through the verbiage said, this isn't all of it, refer to your manuals.
Right. So now you've got to go take it someplace, to go someplace else, more homework, so to speak. And at least with a distance learning module, most distance learning modules are going to have a quiz at the end. So you're more apt to know that. So you're more apt to pay a little more attention to what you're reading.
So all of this was being integrated at the time. Now you combine a co-pilot new to the airplane, a veteran to the airline, but new to the airplane, that's trying to integrate these new procedures. And guess what one of them is?
Oh, make the PA?
The PA.
PA to
now
the...
that sounds trite, right? To the public.
It's might.
Like, wait, this screw up happened because the co-pilot... As opposed to the captain now had to make a PA announcement?
Yeah.
Well, potentially, that's what she may have been
in the middle of.
We don't know.
When the captain made the decision to go someplace else.
Right.
Agreed. And it is.
I think there's more to it.
I'm sure there is.
My gut feeling.
And you can't throw the dart at that one particular. Well, they say every incident or accident has a chain of events.
Right.
Pull out one link and the chain didn't happen. Could that have been one of the links? Perhaps.
Right.
We don't know for sure. And hopefully we'll find out. But yeah, you're just adding to the workload. The first officer, the co-pilot, they're the busiest ones in the airplane while you're on the ground.
Right.
Without question.
Right.
Sometimes... Is that the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, I'd hate to have to blame it just strictly on that, like you said,
of course.
The PA announcement. But here's two aspects that we haven't really talked about. One of the preventions of going through the hole in Swiss cheese beyond what the controller ended up doing was what we call the stop bar system, right?
Oh.
And Kennedy was the first one in 1992, and it instituted sort of a prototype. And I think it's been proved, and now it's universal all over. I don't think they really liked it at first. So we're asking, was it on?
Right.
If it was operational and...
And if it was on, was it seen?
Was it seen?
We have these notice to error missions of things that are not working not functioning as properly designed for certain, nav aids or taxiway closures or things like that.
Right.
Maybe there was a notum for that particular taxiway that the runway stoplights weren't working.
We don't know, but let's, the stop bar is basically, we'll simplifying it. It's just green is go.
Yep.
You can cross that runway.
Big red lights. Stop.
Yeah. And you have to, and if it's on and the controller clears you to cross, you question it.
You have to, you can't just take the word. You've got to question it.
And then the other aspect we did a little pre-briefing before we started this podcast. And one of the things that we talked about is the controllers, have direct control of those lights, or is it an automatic system based on motion sensing, or when an airplane occupies a runway that's about to be used for takeoff?
Yeah.
So we don't
know exactly how that system works.
We don't know how that system works.
Which is maybe not as important as it sounds, but now this incident makes me think more about understanding why and how it works.
Right.
And that would add to our situational awareness,
right,
which is so important.
Right. So I guess all we're doing with our diatribe here is just saying there's a lot involved with this accident.
Yeah.
It seems cut and dry and simple, like let's convict American Airlines crew. But you know what? At the end of the day, there's a good chance those folks are going to have to go back to training. I hope that they are resigned to the fact a mistake was made. And here's the important thing. Let's resolve it so that it never happens again.
And they'll be a big part of that resolution.
Yes.
Upfront and open with their management, with the FAA. I don't know too many pilots that would try to again, because of the pride we take in the job we do and the professionalism that our job requires, if we make a mistake, we own it.
Yeah.
And okay, now how can myself and everybody else out there learn from that mistake?
Right.
And I would think that this crew will have a part in helping figure out that resolution.
It's important. I mean, that's the whole reason for the existence of the National Transportation Safety Board,
yeah.
NTSB, right?
Agreed.
So this investigation will be conducted accordingly. And, you know, the crew knows full well that there's the tower tapes, there's the cockpit voice recording,
yeah.
All the data.
We're being watched and listened to everywhere you go.
Yeah. So there's, you know, confession isn't even necessary. It's like, this is what happened.
Right.
And this is, it really comes down to, okay, this is what I was doing.
Right.
At the time. And because there's no video in the cockpit, but there is.
It's a whole other topic somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and again, the professional of the crew, I would think that they're just going to own it. Hey, we made a mistake. Help us to understand why we made that mistake, and we'll help you to understand why we think we might have made that mistake.
And let's reassure the public that these mistakes are not something that happens on a regular basis.
So uncommon.
Very uncommon. Are there incursions? Yeah, most of it has to do with taxiways.
Correct. Not necessarily the runway, but the taxiway.
And it's never been a situation where it was so critical. Like it just, I shouldn't say never, but it just... this is very, very rare.
It is. Because crossing a runway, the runway is the most important part of flying without the runway. So you've ingrained in your training from day one, you know, as a private pilot, always caution, always maximum situational awareness at or near a runway.
Yeah.
So it's there. Taxiways are similarly taught and trained, but there might be a little bit of latitude, maybe where a little more complacency might come in because you're so used to hearing something. And it could always be a left turn on Bravo to get to runway 4 left or hold short of Kilo, but maybe this time controller says turn left on Alpha. They're parallel taxiways.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of run, these two taxiways run clockwise and counterclockwise around the airport.
But you do speak to a point that, you know, it's the frame of reference with taxiways is not going to be apparent unless I can... You know,
draw a picture
for everybody. But you know, it is a confusing area if you have not been there to some extent, where taxiways and runways are crossing.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's
and then you add night with lights.
Yeah,
my I'm gonna little anecdote here. My early in my years as a captain, like I had just upgraded to captain at. Didn't say it. And we were at Chicago O'Hare.
Or Jamaica, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Air Jamaica. Yeah, I love the islands.
Yeah.
And I had never been to Chicago O'Hare before. And it was dark. It was night. We landed about dusk, managed to get to the ramp. Then we're getting ready to push off to go back to New York or wherever it is where we're going. And we're sitting behind an American Airlines MD-80. And again, typical, you're on the ramp. You talk to ramp gets you to the point, ramp gets you to the on-ramp, and then you talk to ground, and they take you onto the freeway. And the runways they were using at Chicago were way off on the other side of the airport. And Chicago O'Hare has a very complicated taxiway.
That was my biggest scare as upgrading to captain.
Oh.
Because, like you said, a co-pilot's always heads down.
Yeah.
And the airplane I was flying was a 727, which is what we call the Jurassic jet. There was a lot more involved with the task. Our checklist was a lot longer on the taxi
right.
out. And I didn't get the opportunity to see where these captains were going.
Right.
I had a basic idea.
Because you're busy.
Because I'm busy.
Yeah.
So now I'm getting in the left seat, and now I'm the one that's got it. Yeah. But it took studying and just taking your time.
Well, I got lucky this night. Ground control says to the American co-pilot, female co-pilot, taxi to runway blank blank via... blank, 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 and turn left on and hold short of blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there looking at the chart as he's rattling this off, and I'm like, I'm going to be so lost. I jokingly said to my co-pilot, I said, I hope you're that good. Because she rattled it off, I mean, perfectly. Ground control says, JetBlue 1711, follow the American MD-80. Thank God.
Yeah, you always breathe a sigh
but,
of relief.
But yeah, it's taxing. As you know, and it's funny, I'm even taxing in our little aircraft. You know, my wife or my passengers would go, how do you know where you're going on the ground? I said, well, you see those letters and see those numbers and this is what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
But it's
hard.
It's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah. The ground navigation can be
way easier to find something in the air.
Yeah.
Good GPS.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
Man.
Yeah.
Again, and we just spent a lot of time on that subject and we've only hit the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
There may be some follow-up later on.
Oh yeah.
But, and it brings up potentially other subjects to discuss. And again, sure. Give us your questions, you know, invite your friends to look at us and watch us. And if you have a suggestion or a question regarding a topic that we've discussed, send us an email, podcast@candidcockpit.com. We'll mention your name on the air and, we may curse you a little bit for, taking us into the weeds, but, we'll do our best to answer. And if we don't know the answers between us, we're both smart captains. We know people we can call to find out the answer.
True. True. Smart captains ask their co-pilots usually, but
yeah, they're the ones just out of school.
Yeah, exactly. They know it all. And don't forget to watch us on YouTube.
Smiling faces on YouTube.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, we've reached our cruise segment, and we're going to talk about airline pilot hiring criteria. Who's sitting in the cockpit these days? And it's different than it was 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 18 years ago, 34 years ago.
We'll get to that. Let's talk about the basic requirements. I mean, the airlines set their own standards and requirements, and every airline is different. But there are FAA qualifications.
Correct.
As well, right?
Yeah.
So you can't sit right seat or be with an airline until you have 1,500 hours of total time.
Correct. And your ATP. Airline Transport Pilot Certificate.
Correct. And it can be a restricted one, which we won't get into, but restricted just means it's different on your background based on that. It doesn't mean that you're restricted as a pilot. It's just a name for it. But in any case, an Airline Transport Certificate, 1,500 hours. Some airlines require 2-year college degrees. Some of them 4-year college degrees.
Some require none.
And if you do have the college degree, it doesn't matter. Really, even when I was hired, what your subject matter was.
No.
It doesn't. Or what college you went to necessarily.
And I guess it's just to see that you've gone through some higher education and right. you've dedicated yourself to a task.
Right.
Not an easy task.
Right.
And quite frankly, getting hired by an airline is not an easy task. And getting through the training is not an easy task. I think that's why they probably really look at it.
So I guess the point we want to make here is that there are some basic qualifications, minimums for the FAA, minimums for the standards that each particular airline has out there. But more than anything else, it becomes competitive. Who is the group that is has applications in? How are you competitive with,
the guy sitting next to you?
So what does that come down to? Well, if somebody went to the Purdue's of the world or the Embry-Riddle's of the world for a college education as a 4-year degree next to the one that just went to a regular...
San Diego State.
don't we want to put that up there?
I did.
So everything is weighted, and I think it's done very much by computer now. So not only college, but other aspects. What type of flight experience do you have? Somebody that has 2,000 hours towing banners is not going to be as competitive to somebody that has 2,000 hours in, say, a turboprop.
Small turboprop or a corporate jet.
And somebody that has tons of time as a co-pilot, okay, may not be and has total time that's more than their competitor may not be as qualified with somebody that has less time but has been a captain or pilot in command.
Yeah. Decision-making.
So there's a lot that goes into it. It's just competitive for the time.
Then there's the who you know versus what you know.
Well, there is help, and every airline has a policy on that.
Yeah, they do.
You know,
it's not, I don't think it's as prevalent as it maybe once was a long time ago.
Well, it's part of the competitive process. I know when I make recommendations for American Airlines as a retired airline pilot, it gets some weight. Probably not any weight as good as it was back then.
Like a fishing weight, a 3-ounce fishing weight.
But the competitive nature is, hey, there's somebody here that used to fly for us that,
right.
that by theory is respected and has credibility.
And knows this person and their qualifications.
And their qualifications.
And their experience
so
level.
They get up, you know, they get up a little different level. So it's everything is weighted in that way.
It is. We have a similar situation. It's called a blue dart. I can throw a blue dart at someone and they will get the interview. And at that point, the interview is theirs to lose via either the way they did the interview or perhaps their qualifications just aren't strong enough. But it gets them the interview,
right.
Which is still good experience to go to an airline interview.
Sure.
Might help them for the next airline interview they go to if they don't happen to get that job.
So, and you can interject with your experience, but for instance, when I was hired in the 80s, I was one of two civilians out of a class of six. So it was all military background people. I was the one that had the most time. And not only that, I had time in two seats on the airplane that I was going to fly, which was I had a flight engineer experience on the 727, and I had co-pilot experience on the 727.
But so that helped move your competitiveness up a bit.
And I was young. I was 27 years old.
Well, and you had that letter, the note.
Oh, the
the certificate for the
certificate. But I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back by any means. What I'm saying is that was the competitive nature. It was primarily military at that time.
Right.
Military background people was with, and I as a civilian had more time because military people tend to get less time because they're sorties
and they log their time differently.
And they log
quite
their time
a bit differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
My class. There were 24 in my class. I was the third oldest, and I had median flight time at 8,000 hours. I was corporate. There were one pilot that had that was coming straight from the military. Everybody else, now there were other military pilots, but they had been at another airline prior to coming to my company. And there was one pilot in the class that was directly from the military. Everybody else was, I don't even think we had any regional pilots at the time. I think it was coming from other low-cost carriers or carriers that had ATA, USA 3000. We actually had a Spirit pilot.
Well people with airline experience.
Airline experience.
Experience in freight operations.
Yeah, we had cargo,
Or cargo and or passenger, schedule type passenger
right.
use. Yeah,
okay. Now... It's, and again, it took, 8 to 10,000 hours competitive time, flight time. So everybody in our group, sort of our military guy, who still had been in the military for 26 years. So he had a lot of military time that probably added up civilian time to what the rest of us had.
Yeah. Well, you said 8,000 hours. I had 4,500 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cyclical. The hiring seems to be cyclical. Right now we're down to... Basically, ATP, if you have an ATP and you meet that criteria.
An airline transport certificate,
With 1,500 hours, we'll look at you. You'll get an interview.
Right.
And you might have only had 200 hours of jet time at a regional carrier. And you can get hired now at not only a major, but a legacy carrier. And this brings up a point. I just literally read this morning. The most junior captain at Delta Airlines on a 75/76 aircraft has been with the company for 4.5 months. Right?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's the 60s in a way are repeating themselves.
Yeah, because they were scrambling to get pilots back then.
Yeah.
And they were hiring 300 hour. I mean, different requirements way back then.
Right.
They were hiring 300 hour pilots as a co-pilot.
Well, when I got hired, a lot of the co-pilots had been sitting there stagnant in their seats. Anywhere from between 15 and 20 years.
It's just,
and I was a captain in five, and that was reminiscent of the 60s.
Right.
Now it's even less than that.
I mean, almost every airline you can upgrade to a captain inside of a year. I mean, our most junior captain was hired in March of last year. So just under a year.
Yeah.
Now they've been awarded that captain seat, but that captain seat might not happen for several months down the road. For this particular pilot, I happen to know that the captain seat isn't going to be, he won't go to training until December of this year. So he's still going to get time to build experience and fly with captains that can teach him a lot over that year and a half time frame from when he got the seat.
And that's important.
It is.
Important that, and matter of fact, the FAA has mandated a mentoring from captains.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to now go as a captain to mentoring school.
Yeah.
to be able to because it's important.
It is.
They've never had the opportunity to observe and watch a captain. What's a good captain? What's a bad captain? What can I take from this particular trip that I can use when I become a captain?
Right.
That kind of
thing. No, and I learned that too. I upgraded very quickly. I upgraded in just inside of a year. And it's my first time as a captain and for an airline in the airline environment. I've been a captain on corporate jets for a few years, but it's different. It is very, very different.
And it's very different.
Even now as a Czech airman, I'm learning even more about being a good captain.
Right.
And I agree. I've actually said this to our fleet captain. I said, there's things that you train the Czech airman to do that your captains need to be trained on. Mentoring is one, but also some other maneuvers and things in the airplane. But
American Airlines always had the philosophy that they don't hire pilots, they hire captains. So
yeah, and that's I think a lot of airlines have had that, and then we our company did exactly that because we also knew we were a young airline, we were going to grow fast, we were going to upgrade fast. You know, first couple of years here at my company, if you sat 6 months to a year in the right seat, that was a long time. By the time I got there, I got there 5 years after we started business, and we were right at about a year to 14, 16 months before you upgraded. So yeah, you're right. They're hiring captains. And now even that's coming around again. Look at these Delta 4.5 months. It used to take forever to become a Delta. Delta captain.
So sort of a little sidetracked anecdotal story. So when I did get hired, and we do what we call a basic indoctrination class. Mm-hmm. It's basically your first day at school.
Yeah.
And you learn about the airline and, you get to meet your classmates. And there were six of them, like I mentioned before. And I was the youngest one. And I walked in there with my only suit, because that's all I could afford, my blue suit, and a pair of cowboy boots and a mustache that, for those of you that are not watching YouTube, but my mustache was pretty much, the gangster type.
I really got to sit down with your wife and some of your old scrapbook pictures.
Well, I still have it. The funny thing is that there is a picture of the after effect of it. But anyhow, they were all looking at me. All my other classmates were looking at me like, what?
What is that?
What do you belong? You don't even belong here.
You're from Van Nuys?
You're a kid. And they were asking. They basically gave me an interrogation.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, what are your qualifications? Right. And I went through this whole process with them trying to justify my existence and, my dream airline. This, you're not going to ruin this for me. And then, sure enough, the guy that was doing the basic indoc goes through a part in our manual that talks about mustaches. And mine was far past regulation. And I had come from a very casual airline that flew night freight. And I kept it there that whole time. And anyhow, he said, you can't have this. And I just felt about that big.
Learning has occurred.
And I said, I am out of here. I'll go back to the motel and shave it off now. He goes, no. You just can't take your ID picture. But my ID picture that I took the next day.
That would have been beautiful.
It had these white spots on it, and it still has
tan lines.
Tan lines to this day. But that was my hiring experience. I don't know if you got some, but sorry to sidetrack.
You're going to add that visual to the podcast on YouTube, right?
Let's see if I can find the ID. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's a different world.
It is. But I was thrilled to death. Anything you want to add to this discussion?
No, it's just, I think this is going to be a continuing topic as we watch this evolve over the next couple of years with hiring. It's the airline industry in general, seems to be cyclical.
Absolutely.
I don't think that'll
ever change.
No, and this is just part of it.
Yeah. We're going to have a some sort of downturn where people won't fly as much, and we may see furloughs.
I hate to use the F word, but it's got potential, especially with as much hiring is going on right now.
It's somebody explained it to me the best way. The pendulum just starts swinging one way, and it just keeps swinging, and all of a sudden, before you know it, it swings
back the other way.
It swings back the other way. So, yeah.
Yeah. We could keep talking about this. We could talk about educations, and we've done that. We've talked about training. We've talked about hours. I will give a nod to the instructors at our schoolhouses. As a Czech airman, I've been flying with the guys that are right out of training. My job as a Czech airman, I don't know if we've explained this, but your job as a Czech airman is you take the new hire pilots that come out of the schoolhouse. You put them on the line for 25 hours with a Czech airman. And the job of the Czech airman is to fine-tune them from what they've learned in training and also interject a little bit of real-life line flying.
Right, but your primary focus as tasked by the FAA, so folks know as a Czech airman, is to maintain the minimum FAA standards and then the standards of the airline
Correct.
Itself. And you integrate that just like you were saying.
Yeah, and you know, I'll sit with every student, I'll say, look, this is my job, I'm going to fine-tune you, we're going to keep that SOP lane very narrow, because once you start straying even just a tiny, tiny bit out of SOP, and it could be in technique, and there are certain techniques that qualify, will maintain that SOP narrow lane, but once you start straying a little bit, it's easier to go like this,
right.
Almost pendulum effect.
Right.
Who knows, maybe that could be something in this American Delta incident too, as well, that may be revealed by that. But that's my job that's our job. You are a Czech airman as well. That's our job as a Czech airman. And I have been, when I first started seeing, you know, the hiring criteria and the hiring minimums that we're seeing on pilots, new hire pilots, I was like, oh, this isn't going to be good. This isn't going to be fun. I have been pleasantly surprised by the sharpness of the first officer, the new first officer / co-pilot that I have been flying
That's
with.
Great.
Yeah. And it really is. I was having a conversation with an instructor just yesterday, and I said that to him. I said, you know, you guys are doing a great job. And this wasn't even a guy on my airplane, but still, you know, and it really is. It's, that's where it starts.
Well, let's talk about, it's good to know that we can tell the public that we still have qualified pilots that are up there that are taking everybody places, point A to point B. How about attitude? What is, do you notice a different attitude? Are they happy?
Oh, they're ecstatic because at, you know, 2,000 hours they're sitting right seat in a major airline. I did have one new co-pilot that had a little bit of the I know everything attitude. I've just come out of the schoolhouse, and we had to rein him in a little bit. By the end of our 25 hours and 5 days of flying, I was satisfied that attitude wasn't going any farther, and he realized that everything's done for a reason. He was very sharp pilot, but maybe a little too overconfident.
Yeah. Well, that's that's not necessarily indicative of this new
not
hiring
at all.
Generation.
And I'll call him out because this was the only one like that. Everybody else has been very humble.
Right.
And he at the end of our flight time, when I signed him off for his line check, he was like, thanks, Mike, because you really did. You taught me more here regarding my confidence level or my attitude than I learned in the schoolhouse. And you're right. I do. I needed to bring that in. I could see it myself.
Yeah. Well, but, it could come. It'll bite you in some.
Oh,
ways,
yeah.
You know, overconfident attitude. So.
But yeah, these guys are they're happy. They're willing to learn. They're willing to continue to learn. They're in their dream job. I mean, being an airline pilot to a lot of people is a dream job.
Yeah.
I know it was for you. It was on my radar, but you know, it's turned out to be my dream career. I wish I would have done this 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier at that point, because I didn't get into the airline industry till I was 42 years old.
Which I don't think your airline existed before then.
We did not. Not even close.
Yeah, but mine goes back to Lindbergh.
Yeah. I know that guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, had I known then what I know now, I probably would have done this differently.
Yeah.
I would have started a lot younger.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad that our new pilots are happy to be there. And
They are. They're very grateful. And it is. It's nice to see.
Good.
It really is nice to see.
Anything else?
No.
Sort of.
Yeah, we look funny.
Yeah, we look funny.
Okay. We're not stars by any stretch.
No.
But we're trying.
We're trying. Well, everybody, welcome to our final segment, the landing segment. In this particular case, we've got a discussion on abandoning the approach and diverting to an alternate airport, which is an FAA requirement. And we just so happen to have our very own Mike Strauss, who experienced this very thing out in California when all the storms were coming through. And he had to divert elsewhere. So I think this is a great way of kind of explaining how things fold inside the cockpit when this situation occurs. So take it away and we'll talk together about it.
It's again, it kind of goes back to there's a lot going on when you divert, but chances are you've had discussions about the possible diversion before you actually make the decision. This is a case we were flying from New York to San Francisco. Typically, due to weather requirements at certain airports, you may need an alternate, and you might even have a precautionary second alternate. We, in fact, on this trip had, and this comes in, this is very important, we had a second alternate on our release, which basically put more fuel on the airplane, because not only did I have to make it to my alternate that might only be 100 miles away, but now I've got to make an alternate that's 400 miles away.
Right.
Causes a lot more gas. Had we only had the one alternate that turned out to not work for us, we might not have had the gas to get to Los Angeles. The story is, again, 2 weeks ago, the weather's coming into the West Coast.
And sorry to interrupt, but it's important for the public to know that it's an FAA requirement.
It is.
And there's certain parameters of weather that allows you to have that particular alternate. So the weather forecast has to be a certain way. We won't get into the weeds on it, but at the end of the day, an alternate can be a requirement, or it may not be
required. At
all. Really good.
Correct.
But anyhow, go ahead with this.
Yeah, so we had two alternates. We were flying from San Francisco to to New York. Try that one more time. We were flying from New York to San Francisco. We ended up in Los Angeles. Yes,
good trip.
It was a great trip. Actually, it was a good trip. It got me to the ski slopes a day early. Yeah. Anyway, no one likes diverting. The passengers don't. Trust me, the pilots don't. But it's just a way of life. Again, the weather's not going to be good. We knew the weather was going to be good in San Francisco, so it required an alternate. We had two alternates. The first alternate was Sacramento, and its weather was a little iffy, but it met the requirements. Then we had Los Angeles as a second alternate. Typical Southern California weather, clear in a million, right? No issues, no weather problems whatsoever. As we're flying, we're talking about it. We're watching the weather hourly. We talked about the ATIS that happens every hour. We're watching this all the way across the country. We're looking at the minimums. We're looking at the winds, because it can be, might not just be weather. It might be winds and the way the runways are.
Right.
So the runway configuration. So we were watching and talking about this the whole way. We're also keeping an eye on Sacramento, because they have less choices of runway, so wind was more important there.
So what was the relevance of Sacramento?
So the relevance of Sacramento was it was the first alternate, but the winds were picking up to 55 knots out of the east. Sacramento has north-south runways, right, therefore causing a crosswind limitation issue. So almost taking Sacramento...
And crosswind... It means that the wind is going across
the runway,
almost 90 degrees.
Correct. You know, obviously we try to, well, not obviously because a lot of people don't fly, but ideally aircraft will land into the wind
directly. And it's not always possible. It's always an angle,
a little bit of a crosswind angle.
Yeah.
But if there's a direct crosswind, most airplanes, and especially jet airliners, have a crosswind limitation.
Correct.
That you cannot exceed if it's reported. You can't land. It's just simple. Little airplanes have a demonstrated, so it's not necessarily a crosswind limitation. It's just, this is what the test pilot was able to find when they certified the airplane. Right. Anyway, in the airline world, we have hard and fast limitations. Sacramento was now exceeding those limitations. So we kind of already took Sacramento out of our mindset. As we're descending over the Sierra Nevadas and into the San Joaquin Valley, or across the San Joaquin Valley to fly up to San Francisco, which they were landing on runway 19, which for those of you that have been in and out of San Francisco is very rare, and that's indicative of not so good weather in San Francisco. Yeah. So we heard two aircraft come out of Sacramento on a divert. One was a Volaris, which is an aircraft out of Mexico, and I can't remember the other one. I think it was United. And they were both diverting to Los Angeles. We were leading three other aircraft into San Francisco. And we were watching the weather. The ceiling was good. The visibility was decent. But the crosswind was close. And all of that kind of played into the situation where we finally made the decision to divert. But we were leading an American Airlines, a Frontier, and a Southwest. We were the first ones on the approach, and we're getting, you know, beat up pretty good because of the turbulence and the wind and the storms and all the stuff in the air.
What time of day was this?
This was at night. This was actually at about 1 a.m. We had left. It was the late San Francisco flight. So we left New York at about I want to say about 9 p.m.
Gotcha.
And with the time change, we're getting into San Francisco right about 1. And on about a 2-mile final, we are configured to land. We are ready to land. We have it in our minds that we are landing. And the tower says microburst alert over the runway. And going back to potentially another topic of weather, microburst is what brought down a Delta L-1011 at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. And microburst is basically
Years and years ago, yeah.
Yeah, 1985. A microburst is one of those things that if it's happening here, you're going the opposite direction. It is the bottom of a thunderstorm more or less falling out all at once.
It's a wind event, a very, very, very serious wind event that can be very a high velocity.
And it goes in different directions. I mean, it comes down and goes in 360 degrees direction. It's a mess. Like I said, a whole other topic.
But it's a very finite area. In other words, it's not wind that's been prevailing. Wind that is
right there.
Yeah, and it's basically coming down and spreading across.
And it makes it very difficult to land or control the aircraft.
Right.
Before we could even, and my co-pilot and I looked at each other, and before I could get the words go around, he was flying. Before I get the words go around flaps out of my mouth, the tower controller comes and says, another microburst alert has taken place right over the runway. So we did exactly that. We went around, knowing immediately we weren't going to stick around and wait for this situation to clear, which in a lot of times you can do that.
Yeah, my airline had the policy that you get a microburst alert, you're done. Whether you get it on your instrumentation,
right,
or will you get it from the control?
Yeah, same with us.
You're done.
You either go hold and wait some way, right. And you can do that. But we had already we'd already decided that if anything happens, if we have to go around, weather related, we're just going straight to LA. We're not going to mess with it. We've already had a very long night. It's the middle of the night. We have enough gas to get to LA, but we don't necessarily have a lot of gas to stick around to try again at San Francisco. So we immediately make the decision. We're going to Los Angeles. And before Tower's even done talking to us, the American Airlines behind us says, we're going to Fresno. The Frontier flight says, as we're talking to approach Tower gives us our go-around instructions, and now we're going to talk to departure, and they ask us what are our intentions, and we said we're going to Los Angeles. Well, it's the same frequency that was talking to us on approach. Frontier says we're going to Los Angeles, and Southwest says we're going to fly around a little bit and see how it goes. We'll leave that alone.
Listen, everybody makes their own decision.
No, right, and I'm not going to question.
They may have plenty of gas.
Yeah, and I'm not going to question it.
Yeah,
situation.
May have rectified it.
But we just weren't. We decided, the weather there was just so bad all day long. We just didn't want to stick around to see if it improved. We were just going to go.
Right.
So again, it gets very busy. We've got to talk to company. We've got to talk to departure. We've got to tell them what we're doing, where we're going, and how we want to do it. They pretty much said, turn left, go south, and we'll figure out a flight plan for you. Climb and maintain. So my first officer is still flying. Once we get stabilized in that new climb to our new destination, that's when I get to do some administrative work, so to speak. I've got to contact our company via ACARS, Aircraft Reporting System. It's a text message. Aircraft Communications and Reporting System.
Yeah.
So we can text message with our company. So I've got to let San Francisco know, hey, by the way, we're not coming in. I got to let LA know we're coming. I got to let dispatch know, and they're going to send us a new release to verify how much fuel we've got. We can, in fact, make this flight to Los Angeles, or maybe we look at someplace a little closer. I got to talk to the passengers. I got to tell them, hey, San Francisco, it's a little warmer down in Los Angeles. This is where we're going.
All that stuff is happening behind that cockpit.
Yeah.
And the passengers are probably a little anxious, right?
Yeah, they want some information.
But you're busy.
Yeah, very.
And most seasoned travelers know that that's probably the case.
Right.
But it's good to tell everybody exactly what's.
We got my in-flight crew handled it very well with everybody, and I guess the PAs that I made keeping everybody informed. We got a lot of compliments.
Communication's important.
Once we got to Los Angeles, and nobody was upset. And they were like, when do we get to San Francisco? And the company was great. By the time we got to LA at about 2 o'clock in the morning, they had already called out a reserve crew to get here to the airport to get the airplane ready and then load the passengers and fly them up to San Francisco. That said, the weather didn't clear as quick as I wanted to, and they didn't get to San Francisco until about 6:15 that morning, so right. About 4-hour delay.
But here's the takeaway, at least what I'm getting, is that you were almost all the way across the country. You were already planning this.
Oh.
You know, it's like, if this happens, we're going to do A, B, C. So that is very important aspect of it. In other words, this wasn't a surprise.
No.
You knew what you had to do, and your mindset was such that you were ready to do it.
Right. And once you make that decision, you've got to stick with that decision. You can't second guess it.
Right.
Yeah. Now, granted, sometimes go-arounds and diversions are split-second decisions. You know, you're landing here, but something could happen on that airport that could shut that airport down for some reason.
Or somebody didn't get off the runway fast enough.
Right, exactly. So that's a different – so, yeah, that's just a regular go-around. But even a regular go-around, going from that, I'm landing, oh, no, I'm climbing now. There's a lot of stuff that goes on. You know, you got to reconfigure the aircraft with the gear and the flaps and climb power and where am I going?
Right.
You know, so, and some of that comes down to there are certain go-around procedures for almost every approach. So that is already loaded into the FMS, or the tower may say, hey, just fly runway ahead and climb to 3,000 feet and we'll work something out for you. But it is, it's a handful, kind of like taxiing.
It is. But that's what experience and judgment and all that is involved with being up there.
Yeah. So. No, it's why we, you know, get paid those pennies. And it's funny because those are the times where we earn our pay.
Right.
You know, in those critical times of flight.
You know, for me, diverting was easy from the standpoint of if we were out there doing circles, and you know, I'll bring up one example. We were about 25 miles to the south of Kennedy on one time coming up from South America after an all-night flight. And you know, the weather was starting to go downhill. The visibility was not looking good. And I'm thinking, we have plenty of gas to hold, but why wait here?
Yeah.
Just let's get to our alternate airport. Put the folks on the ground because they're going to end up there anyhow. They're not going to end up in New York more than likely.
Right.
And let's get there ahead of everybody else. So we have a gate assignment, and we're not in line to get fuel to go, you know,
go back to where you're going. Or you could run into, you know, now if you've got all these airplanes that are diverting to the same airport for the same reason, now you've created traffic issues and traffic flow issues at the airport that's not really expecting you. So yeah, good point. Yeah, we were lucky. We were number one in that line of four,
right?
And only one of them followed us, and they were easy to outrace.
but this is you know, this is unscheduled operations for the airline. You know, they've got gates allocated very tightly. Yeah. You know, for regular scheduled departures and arrivals. Now you add a diversion.
Oh, where's this guy coming from?
Where's this coming
from? Right. So, and now we've got to find a place to put him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it can get serious, but great story.
Yeah, it was, it wasn't just me. I mean, we fly with the crew. Granted, I'm the guy in charge of the crew or takes all the responsibility of the crew, but it was the entire crew knew what to do, how to do it. The training kicked in and everybody was happy. And more importantly, we were all safe on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, like I said, I went to illegal, so it got me to my skiing trip a day early. And everybody still got to San Francisco within, you know, a few hours of when they were supposed to. So it wasn't horrible, but yeah, all together.
There's always a rainbow in something that...
It's got to be, man. Yeah.
Very good. Well, Captain Mike, we've landed this episode of Candid Cockpit. We got our brakes parked, and they're not in LA.
Right?
Yeah.
Although it feels like a transcon flight.
So we're going to, I see the jet bridge is on its way up to us, and I hope everybody got a little insight to what we do behind that cockpit door, as usual.
Yeah.
And the next episode, we're going to discuss what it is like to fly that very first trip as an airline pilot. We kind of teased it a little bit. But
with some of the new hires we're getting now, and when we did it,
I think it'll be fun insight.
Yeah, no, it is, and there's some great stories about that too. It is kind of fun. Anyway, we'll get to that. That's next episode. Transcon, we're already at the gate. We're done flying.
Yeah, we're done flying.
You know, while we begin the parking checklist, I just once again want to ask our listeners to get on their own PA, spread the word about our podcast to your friends and family. And please send us an email to podcast@candidcockpit.com. Let us know if you've got a topic or a question or something, you know, maybe it's a rebuttal to something we've said or a question that may, we might have aroused in your mind with the conversation we've had.
A rebuttal? We can't be wrong.
Well, that's why there's two of us, right? So we're both not wrong.
That's right.
You know, and we'll address the topic. And we'd love to answer your questions because, you know, we've got a lot of things in our mind, but we might not have, you know, we're not the flying public and you've got the questions. This is why we're here. So send us that email. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. Where else? Are we on NBC yet?
No. Oh. But we are, our friends at RM Travel, who have a travel network radio station that they have a syndicated, they went over 500. They have been very kind to promote us.
So, awesome.
So I'm giving them a little boost here. So if you're a traveler, check with the with them as well, RM Travel.
Yeah, awesome. Well, let's see. Anything else you want to add?
Well, no, other than, listen, don't get on an airplane unless you've listened to Candid Cockpit. We're glad you came with us today. Have a great safe flight.
Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.